You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Jones. I'm the Deputy Director for the Foreign Policy Program here at Brookings, and it's a pleasure to welcome you all here this morning, new friends and old. I'm very grateful to the weather gods for not snowing us out. We had a slightly nervous night last night. I'm a relatively new resident to Washington, and I'm always amazed when I see the city close down with a half inch of snow, and I wonder how it is we won the Cold War and we can't even fight off an inch of snow. But fortunately, we did not have to confront that particular trauma today. Let me start this morning by welcoming Bates Gill, who is the CEO of the U.S. Studies Center, and really being the driving force behind this event, together with James Brown, the director of Alliance 21. The U.S. Studies Center at the University of Sydney is arguably the leading institution outside of the United States that tries to think about the United States and, of course, also about the U.S.-Australia relationship. And we're delighted to be hosting this event this year, in which we'll scrutinize a number of aspects of the relationship and, in so doing, celebrate it. It's an alliance that, as you all know, dates back to the Second World War. But I have to say, I think that the dynamics in Asia right now really reinforce, certainly in this city, how vital the relationship is and how important that alliance is. And there's probably never been as important a time to really put the spotlight on the relationship and to dig into what's working and what's not in some of the security and economic and other dynamics. So it's a pleasure also to be working with Alliance 21, which started in 2001 as a project to pull together U.S. and Australian scholars and policy experts. Michael Hanlon and Josh Meltzer from this institution have participated in that process. Last year's conference was held in January of 2014 at CSIS, and that was an important success, and we're very happy to be hosting this year's conference. And before I turn over to Bates to do a broader welcome, let me thank two colleagues of mine who've really done the lion's share of work in pulling it together, Tom Wright, who's the director of our project on international order and strategy, and Rob Keane, who's a colleague in the same project and who've really done all the work in pulling this together. And I'm very much grateful to them, as is Martin Indyk, who unfortunately can't be here today. He's off at Davos, as one is, but he was very enthusiastic about us hosting this event. As you know, Martin Indyk is Australian. I was born in Sydney. It appears that you have to have some Australia to connection to have a leadership role in the foreign policy program at Brookings, so that's another testimony to the alliance. Before I turn over, let me mention that if you want to tweet about the event, we're at AusUS. And let me also ask you please to silence your cell phones. And with that, let me turn over to Bates. Where is Bates? There he is. Bates, please.
Thanks very much, Bruce. And let me extend my warm welcome to everyone here this morning and my great gratitude to be here again at the Brookings Institution, one of my former professional homes, and to work so closely with you, Bruce, and with Tom and your whole team. Greatly appreciate it. I extend thanks as well to Strobe and to Martin Indyk for being so open, even though they weren't able to be here, to us being a part of this event with you in Washington. Also want to extend my gratitude to the supporters of the U.S. Studies Center and in particular supporters of the Alliance 21 program, which is really one of our flagship think tank programs at the U.S. Studies Center at the University of Sydney, our corporate supporters, and in particular the Australian government, Ambassador Beasley, who we hope to see a little bit later today, Foreign Minister Bishop, have been great supporters for us, and we're so appreciative of all of that. We're here at a time of a 2 or 3 week set of events that the Australian government's supporting, known as G'day USA. You may pick up some of the other events that they're doing across the country this month, and we're glad to be one of their policy programs here at Brookings. We're here today once again to try and get a little bit of attention and some time spent in understanding the importance of the U.S.-Australia relationship. Yes, it's a security pact. Yes, it's was defined by the Cold War period and under the ANZUS Treaty. But it's much more than that, and I think that's what we're going to learn about today. This is a broad and deep relationship. I think it is the most important alliance relationship the United States has in the Asia-Pacific region, and I think it has almost no other equal among American relationships in the world. It is a special relationship. And what we're going to learn about today is just how deep and how broad that is, and the sort of fundamental shared interest that our two countries have together in partnership. Looking ahead, we have a lot of challenges. We know that we want to try to get the TPP done. We are facing global challenges in the form of terrorism and political violence around the world. We have geopolitical dynamics in the Asia-Pacific region, which are both great opportunities, but of course also challenges to alliances like the United States-Australia relationship. And we're going to hear from some great experts today on all of these topics. So I'm very much looking forward to the conversation. I want to thank the Brookings Institution once again for the opportunity to work together, and looking forward to a great day. Let me turn the floor over then to our colleague from the Brookings Institution, Tom Wright. Thank you.
Here at Brookings, and I would like to thank Bates and Bruce, of course, for those kind introductions, and just say it's a great pleasure to be here today and to be partnering with the University of Sydney and with Bates and with all our friends from Australia on this important event. We're delighted for our first panel to have a conversation with two of the senior and most influential, I think, officials on either side of the alliance, Evan Medeiros and Andrew Shearer. And so I'm going to ask them a few questions, and then we'll throw it open to the audience a little bit later. Evan is a senior director for Asia on the National Security Council. He's served in the Obama administration for over 6 years, I think, now, and on the National Security Council.
A dubious distinction.
And has been integral, really, to the rebalance and to U.S.-Asia policy during that time. Prior to going into government, he was a senior political scientist in China studies at RAND and also was a senior researcher at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies in Monterey, California. And he's a leading scholar on China, U.S.-China relations and Asia. So we're delighted to have him back here again. And Andrew is the senior advisor on national security affairs to the Prime Minister of Australia, Tony Abbott. He previously served in the same position, I think, for Prime Minister John Howard, and previous to that had senior positions at the Australian Embassy here in Washington, D.C., and at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. I've known Andrew for over 15 years, I think, now. He's a good friend, so it's a particular pleasure to welcome him here to Washington, and I'm always very impressed when Australians come over in the middle of their summer and winter here, so to give up some of that vacation time. So thank you for that. What I'd like to start with is by noting really a few developments, I think, over the last year that are particularly interesting, and then ask you how U.S.-Australia, the alliance sort of fits into that. Because if you look back, you know, the president had a State of the Union last night, and we'll come back to that a little bit later on. But a couple of things are sort of striking in terms of how the world has evolved. One thing is that, you know, the United States has bounced back beyond most expectations. And the economy is doing much stronger than it was a year ago. Really, there's now a divergence between the U.S. amongst major industrialized countries and other economies. I mean, the IMF the other day revised its numbers for most other countries downward, but for the U.S., it revises upward. And to the extent that people used to be working whether or not the U.S. would be able to implement the rebalance or would be there in Asia because, you know, you need to fix your problems at home was sort of the mantra. And until you do that, there's a shadow over U.S. leadership. That shadow would appear to be less so today than it was a year ago. So that's a very positive development. But on the international situation, particularly globally, there's been a significant, you know, deterioration. We've seen with the rise of ISIL during the year in the Middle East and really the continuing implosion of the Middle East and the regional order there and Russian aggression in Eastern Europe and, of course, the tragic events that led to the downing of MH17. And interestingly, Australia was very much involved in, obviously, tragically, in the response to MH17, but also in responding to the rise of ISIL and being part of that security relationship with the US as a core sort of ally in responding to that. And amidst all of that, we have the continuing sort of long-term challenges in Asia. And it's sort of funny that Asia seems a little more stable and a little less crisis-ridden than Europe. I mean, who would have thought that, you know, 12 months ago, which is sort of extraordinary, but those, you know, long-term challenges haven't gone away. So my question is, given all of that, given a rebounding U.S., given global crises and problems, and given the sort of continuing long-term challenges of Asia, are we in a new strategic moment? How would you describe sort of the strategic environment, and where does the alliance sort of fit into that? What is its role going forward? So, Evan, if we might start with you, and then we'll turn over to Andrew.
Thanks, Tom. Let me begin by thanking Bates and Bruce and you, Tom, for sponsoring this conference. In government work, it's the relationships that work best and do the most that sometimes get the least attention, especially from non-government scholars. And so it's really helpful to have a conference like this, buttressed with the great report that Bates did on Alliance 21, that I think provides useful ideas, insights into how we should think about the U.S.-Australia relationship going forward. And so the fact that you've agreed to sponsor this conference and you've gotten such high-quality participation from Australia, especially the fact that we could get Indra away for a week, is absolutely fantastic. So I applaud Brookings and the U.S. Study Center for sponsoring this. The potential for this relationship is really extraordinary. It's been one of the greatest pleasures of being senior director is working on the U.S.-Australia relationship. And so let me make two points in response to your question about where the U.S.-Australia relationship fits. The first is a strategy point, because it's always good to start with the big, broad strategy point. And the Obama administration has been very clear about its commitment, its strong commitment to the Asia-Pacific. The president mentioned it in his speech last night. And as the president said in his speech in Brisbane, there's sort of two logics to what we're trying to do in the Asia-Pacific. The first is the U.S. being more engaged in the region to shape the regional security order, economic order, and political order in ways that advance American interests. But increasingly, it's also about a second component, which is working with our partners, our friends, and our allies in the Asia-Pacific to do more globally. And that is, it's not just about America doing more in Asia, it's about working with Asia to do more globally. And, you know, in that context, there is no better partner than Australia. I can't think of a single regional or global challenge in which there's not high-quality, consistent cooperation from Australia. I mean, think about the big global challenges of our time. Non-proliferation, ISIL and countering violent extremism, Ebola, cybersecurity, renovating the international trade regime, China's rise, India's rise, climate change, on all of them there's a very active conversation between the U.S. and Australia. So I would say, in answer to your first question, you know, Australia is at the center of you know, our strategy in the Asia-Pacific, which, as I mentioned, has both a regional component and a global component. Which leads me to my second point, which is, you know, when we talk about executing this strategy toward the Asia-Pacific, we've always identified modernizing our alliances as a central component of it. And we're very clear about what that means. It's not just a tagline. There are real ideas there. First and foremost, it's about making sure that security cooperation, the security relationship between us, continues to meet the threats and the challenges facing us. And I'll talk about that in a moment. But more broadly, and I think that something that is distinctly Obama and something that we have pursued very deliberately over the last 7 years is ensuring that our alliances are more than just military institution focus on deterring and responding to security threats. That's there. It'll always be there. I said that that's a big part of our alliance strategy, but it's more than that. It's about building political military institutions. In other words, the alliance is about building an institution that has an economic component, diplomatic component, and then, of course, a security component to focus on both regional and global challenges. And that derives from the fact that we are interested in building a rules-based regional and international order in which we use rules, norms, institutions including alliances, not just multilateral institutions, as a way to shape the regional security order. And that's something that is sort of fundamental to how the Obama administration thinks about the U.S. role in the world, how we think about the U.S. role in Asia, and that's a view that is perfectly shared between Washington and Canberra. And that's profound and significant, and that's what gives sort of, that's the foundation of this alliance, and that's what gives us momentum, it gives us direction, and, you know, it's ideas like that that I think lead us to conclude that the alliance, both the U.S.-Australia alliance, but our alliances more broadly, are not Cold War relics. They're not something that were created in the Cold War and have just, you know, and haven't adapted as the international environment has adapted. In fact, it's the very opposite. I would say that the work that Andrew and I have done and we've done with previous administrations have been focused on making sure that the alliance does evolve, both the security dimensions and this agenda of building it into a political military institution. So I think it's, you know, it's important when we address the regional conversation about alliances that we keep this in mind, that they're not outdated institutions. And in fact, it's the U.S.-Australia alliance is one of the most sort of modern practical institutions that the United States has for dealing with regional and global challenges. It's very much a working alliance, and it's something that Andrew and I, we had a private lunch yesterday just to sort of touch base on a whole variety of different issues, and we both remarked how sort of practical and hands-on this alliance is. And what I mean is, you know, just I yesterday after lunch I gathered up a few facts. Since 2009, President Obama has met or talked with his Australian counterpart nearly 40 times. As we all know, the president has visited Australia twice. With Prime Minister Abbott alone, they've met 3 times. They've talked on the phone 6 other times. And these are long, extensive phone calls that often extend far beyond the Asia-Pacific. Of course, we have our annual AUSMIN ministerials, lots of other interactions between our various secretaries on the margins of meetings all over the world. Basically, we consult with Australia on every important issue. And Andrew and I are regularly in contact. You know, one of the virtues of being alliance partners is we have all sorts of, you know, fancy secure links, phone, video, that allow very easy contact. I have a phone on my desk that I can pick up and get Andrew on the phone, assuming I calculate the time difference correctly. Which sometimes can be a little embarrassing if you get it wrong. But my point is simply that this is an alliance that works on a day-to-day basis. It's a good day for me when I talk to Andrew or Kim about working an issue. And I think that we've got real successes to show for it over the last few years. There's some big high-profile ones that everybody knows about. The MAGTAF to Darwin, the Forced Posture Agreement, which sets the foundation for even greater cooperation in U.S. presence in Australia, close defense procurement, P-8s, F-35s. But there's a lot of stuff that I think is below the radar. Our close cooperation and work in Iraq and Afghanistan, very close consultation in the U.N. Security Council. I mean, Australia's presidency of the Council in September of 2013, November of 2014 was critical to several initiatives. And in response to MH17, Foreign Minister Bishop showed real leadership and was the key person driving a UN Security Council response. We've relocated a space surveillance radar to Australia. We've included cyber attacks as part of the scope of our alliance commitments. But there are economic components as well. 2015 is the 10th anniversary of the U.S.-Australia FTA. We, the United States, is Australia's biggest economic partner, and we take that very seriously. And over the last 10 years of the FTA, exports to Australia have grown nearly 90%. The United States is the second largest source of imports for Australia. And then, of course, we've been close partners on TPP. And as all of you heard last night, the president has now asked the Congress for TPA. We're in the end game, and we're going to get this done. But, of course, we work very closely together in the Asia-Pacific. One of the initiatives that Andrew and I worked most closely on and required very careful coordination was building out our trilateral security cooperation, that is U.S., Australia, Japan, in a way that makes sure that our military and our diplomatic establishments are working together in new and innovative ways to build an architecture for the region that addresses the challenges facing the Asia-Pacific. And then, of course, one of the biggest challenges we face is the rise of China, and that's something that we talk about and we consult about. And both of us want a stable, productive, prosperous relationship with China. We see China's rise as an opportunity. You know, we have our concerns. There are uncertainties about China's future. But I think that we're working with China where we can to ensure that its rise is a source of stability and prosperity. And when we have opportunities, we pursue innovative ways to work with China. Two of the most recent ones are trilateral initiatives on the military and security side. In October of last year, a little-known but very important trilateral military exercise happened between the U.S., Australia, and China in Australia related to survival training. And we as Americans tried to get the Australians to invite Crocodile Dundee as a sort of special guest to the exercise, but they didn't go for it. But on the economic side, we've got some interesting trilateral economic cooperation as well. There is a, in Queensland, there's a very interesting trilateral initiative between an Australian, American, and Chinese company in which they are, it's an LNG export operation in Queensland to basically extract the LNG and provide it onto the global market. But that's just, you know, one of many examples of how, you know, when big questions about China's rise, India's rise come up, we're constantly in communication, we're looking for opportunities to coordinate, and we're looking for creative ways to sort of reach our shared goals. So with that, let me turn it over to Andrew. Great to see you again.
Thanks, Evan. Great to see you. And I'd just like to start by thanking the US Study Center for having me here, and also thanking Brookings. And what I'd like to do is really add to Evan's excellent survey of the alliance, the contemporary alliance between our two countries, with some personal observations about how this looks and how it works from an Australian perspective. As both Tom and Evan said, we're facing a very challenging international environment, and for Australia in recent weeks, certainly quite a challenging domestic security environment also. If I just review last year, which I had a bit of occasion to do on the beach recently, and I think about that year, it was extraordinary for its intensity and the sort of overlapping waves of crisis. I think maybe that's too dramatic a way to put it, but we dealt with the fallout from the Snowden revelations, which affected our relations in the region profoundly, particularly with Indonesia. We launched within 6 hours a search for the missing Malaysian airliner MH370. US was very quick to send an aircraft, which is yet another practical demonstration of this powerful alliance. But we put together a regional coalition to search for that aircraft, and that search unfortunately goes on today. We had, as Evan said, the rise of ISIL profound concerns about this phenomenon of foreign terrorist fighters. And the Prime Minister was very pleased to join the President at the summit in New York on that in September. We had continuing global economic fragility. We had continuing maritime tensions in East Asia. We had cyber attacks. And we had the shooting down of, who would have thought it, another Malaysia Airlines aircraft over eastern Ukraine. So really quite an extraordinary array of different issues, and I've just picked out some highlights or perhaps some lowlights. In our response to all of these events, the point I'd like to make is that the alliance has been absolutely front and centre. So just thinking about MH17 and the effort to recover the victims of that atrocity. We deployed with our Dutch colleagues about 150 unarmed Australian police officers to within 20 kilometres of the Russian border in the middle of a conflict zone. There were quite a few commentators in Australia who thought that this was a very foolish thing to do indeed. We and the Dutch government felt very strongly that we owed it to the families of the people on that aircraft to do that. But the thing that gave us ultimately the assurance and the confidence to proceed with that mission was the fact that we did so with this massive bubble of American ISR support around our people. As someone who's involved in making these decisions, which are obviously life and death decisions, the confidence that comes from having that incredible technological support, but also that really strong moral, diplomatic and political support, makes a profound difference to those decisions and empowers us to do things that we couldn't otherwise do. The intelligence dimension of the alliance has always been important, right back to the establishment of the joint facilities in Australia, but it's even more important today when I think about the other challenges that we face. So maritime awareness in East Asia, the intelligence relationship is absolutely pivotal. I think about the foreign fighter threat and counterterrorism and the challenges we face there, where our intelligence relationship with the US and the broader Five Eyes intelligence relationship is becoming even more important day by day. And then I think of the military dimension of the alliance. And I think in the last 15 years or so, we've seen the most intense military cooperation between Australia and the United States that we've seen, I guess, maybe since the Vietnam War and possibly earlier. And today, Australian forces are serving alongside US forces in Afghanistan, which sometimes tends to be, I think, overlooked, trying to stabilise that country and make sure it doesn't again pose a threat as a terrorist haven, but more prominently perhaps in Iraq, where we have the second largest contribution behind the United States. We've got a potent air task group operating in Iraq, and we've got special forces on the ground as well. So the military dimension of the alliance, as Evan said, is far from a Cold War relic. It's a dynamic and current asset to both our countries. And then there's the vast range of global and regional issues where we work together, and I think Evan put it really well. Australia is an open, liberal trading economy. We have a massive stake in an open, rules-based international order and trading order, and the alliance, again, is a powerful force multiplier for us in supporting those interests and again, Evan put it really well, I think this is a working alliance. We talk every day about these issues. That's not to say we agree on every issue every day, but we certainly understand each other's perspectives. We support each other where we can. And if there are differences, which I have to say are few, we can find ways to work through those. I really appreciate the contact that I have with Evan and his team at the NSC every day. The alliance is a critical contributor to maintaining our regional order during a time of shifting power, relativities. The Force Posture Initiative, I think, is profoundly important. It's a way that we can work together to shape our regional environment in ways that are positive, in ways that reinforce openness of trade, freedom of navigation, stable dealings with our regional partners. And there's a debate often in Australia about whether our alliance with the United States holds us back as a country in our dealings with our regional partners. And I just want to profoundly reject that notion. I think it works entirely the other way around. Our strong regional engagement is an asset in our dealings with the United States, and Evan and I will often talk about share perspectives about our dealings with Indonesia and Southeast Asia and the South Pacific, for example. But by the same token, a strong alliance with the United States is a powerful reinforcer of our engagement in our region. And my experience over a number of years is that our regional partners value the fact that we have close ties with Washington, that we have good access to the administration, that we understand the direction of US policy. And I think this is a virtuous circle rather than some difficult conflict that we have to manage. I'll leave it there, except for one observation, which struck me watching the State of the Union last night. For a number of years, a lot of discussion about the alliance has been framed by struggling US economic growth and rampant Chinese economic growth. And I think it's interesting and just yet another sign of how quickly things are changing at the moment that we're having this meeting today against the backdrop of concern, and this affects Australia profoundly, about a slowing Chinese economy and a sense of resumed optimism about the US economy, which again is doing what it does and frankly what I expect it will continue to do, and that is show enormous resilience and flexibility and dynamism. So I'll leave it there.
Thank you to both of you for those terrific opening remarks. I'd like to start maybe with the news of the day and with the State of the Union and with trade. So last night I felt that the President was much more forceful in his advocacy of trade than he was in last year's State of the Union. Last year there was a lot of expectation. You know, he mentioned it somewhat in passing. But last night he spent a minute or two on it. He made a case for passing a TPA. It was in the domestic part of the speech, which I thought was interesting. He framed it as protecting American workers against China, which is also an interesting frame. And he said that the United States and its allies must write the rules or China will. Also, I thought, curiously, it was one part of the speech where Democrats stayed seated after he made those remarks and Republicans gave him an ovation. And later on, I found a quote last night, it was in Politico this morning, where Oregon Congressman Peter DeFazio said, trade what is number one, number two, number three, and number four in terms of things that we find objectionable to the speech, amongst a lot of other things that we liked. So clearly there's an issue still with House Democrats, but there is now a Republican majority in the House and the Senate. So my question is this going to, you know, get done in the near future? Is 2015 going to be the year when, you know, TPP is finally closed out? Evan?
No pressure.
Right. The simple answer is yes. The more complicated answer is, I think the President made very clear last night that TPA and TPP is now a top presidential priority. and now is the time to get it done. We're confident we can and we will get it done. The U.S., I think, is in the end game of its negotiations with TPP partners about what needs to be completed, both the market access component and the rules-making component. And the fact that we're now going to, the president has requested TPA from the Congress is the political signal that the goal is to get it completed in 2015. And what's important is that, as we all know, TPP is a very, very significant component of our broader rebalancing strategy. TPP for us is obviously a critical economic agreement, but it's also part of our broader strategy. And we understand both the strategic and the economic advantages that flow from TPP. And that's understood and articulated at the very top. And I think that's provides even more sort of reason why we're going to, the administration will push to get it done this year.
Great, thanks. What's the perspective on this debate, the Trade Promotion Authority debate, but also the broader TPP and negotiations from Australia?
Well, I just think this is hugely important. It's a totemic part of the triad, I guess, that is the rebalance. The military aspect of the rebalance is crucial, obviously, and Australia through the Force Posture Initiative is a key part of that. The diplomatic strand of the rebalance is obviously very important, and the President's made a number of recent high-profile and successful visits to the region, which have reinforced US commitment and engagement in the region. But I think countries in the Asia-Pacific are really looking very closely at this to see whether the United States can muster the political will, if you like, to lead again on trade issues in the region. So I think this is hugely important. Australia strongly supports the TPP.
If we could maybe move from trade into the question of, you know, institutions and regional institutions. One of the, you know, few areas, I think, over the last, you know, 12 months where there has been, you know, where there's been a difference maybe of view in the debate in Australia and here has been on the, you know, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, but that's more broadly symptomatic of you know, China's greater activism in building sort of regional institutions and other institutions. So how should we think about this? I mean, we have a security component to this, obviously, but there's also, you know, the fact that the world is increasingly interdependent, and Australia's position has often been noted as being very, you know, much between the not wanting to choose between the U.S. and China. So is the U.S. slightly overreacting on some of this Chinese, you know, activity? It's more sort of better all round, or what are the sort of main concerns? And Andrew, if we might start with you on this.
Sure. Well, I think, I mean, the starting point, and Evan, again, put this well, is that we welcome China's rise. China's rise has been a good thing for the region. It's been an incredibly good thing for the Australian economy and for the standard of living of Australians. So, you know, that's a powerful and important development, which we've welcomed very strongly. By the same token, we're very keen to see that China makes a strong contribution to the regional structures and frameworks, but does so in a way which is consistent with the traditions that we believe in around openness and transparency. China, I think, is trying to make a stronger contribution, and overwhelmingly, I think we see this in positive terms. There's been a little bit of controversy about the Asian Infrastructure Bank proposal. I mean, our position on this is pretty clear-cut. There's a massive demand for infrastructure in Asia and a shortage of funds to build the infrastructure that Asia is going to need. So on the face of it, China's initiative is very, very welcome indeed. And our position is that we will participate in the bank if its governance is satisfactorily open and transparent. And there's a continuing discussion to have around that. So I don't think, I mean, Evan can pick me up if I've got this wrong, but I don't think there's a massive gulf here between our positions. And I think I think it's a welcome thing if there are new institutions which complement the institutions that are there already. But we'd like to see, for example, Infrastructure Bank be a genuinely multilateral body with open and transparent governance.
Evan?
So let me pick up the institutional aspect of your question, because from the perspective of the Obama administration, institutions play a critical role in the regional economic security and political architecture of the Asia-Pacific, and it's something that we've invested in very substantially in terms of regular participation in the key forums like the ASEAN Regional Forum, the ADMM+, and then the president's strategic decision to join the East Asia Summit, to attend regularly, and then to build that into the principal political security forum in the region. I've been to the EAS twice, in 2013 and 2014. It's extraordinary when you have 18 leaders from throughout the Asia-Pacific around the table talking about the big challenges facing them. I mean, it's an action-forcing event. I think it helps set the agenda for the subsequent year. And so these institutions in the Asia-Pacific, you know, they're evolving. They're not nearly as sort of, they're not as many of them, and they're not as well-developed as Europe during the Cold War, but they serve critical functions. They facilitate and lubricate cooperation. They help set sort of rules as a baseline for how nations should conduct behavior. They serve as mechanisms for sharing information, and as a result, transparency, which results in greater predictability in behavior. And they also bind everybody, because part of membership is being subject to the views of others, the peer pressure of others, and, you know, occasionally the restrictions associated with membership. That's a good thing. That creates a much more predictable environment. And that's something that we think is important. 2015 is a significant year for that, because it's the 10th anniversary of the founding of the East Asia Summit. It's also the year in which ASEAN has agreed to form their economic community, which we think is a good thing, and it's something that the U.S. wants to be an even more active member with ASEAN in. So when it comes to new proposals like the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, I agree with Andrew. We think this is a very creative initiative. It clearly reflects a need. You know, we think that China identified a very significant gap, which is the lack of both private and public funding available for infrastructure. The question is, how do you do that? How do you best access public and private finance to build and renovate infrastructure throughout Southeast Asia? And so when we look at the AIIB, we don't oppose it. The President and Prime Minister Abbott said this publicly after their meeting actually in Beijing. If you look at the transcript of their press conference, Andrew and I have talked about this multiple times. We've, you know, this impression that has existed, especially in the Australian media, that somehow America was twisting Australia's arm is simply incorrect, but rather, we both have questions. And as we all know, the AIIB is not even formed yet. The articles of agreement don't exist yet. So from the American perspective, how do you join an institution that doesn't even exist and some of the basic fundamental attributes of it, like Andrew mentioned, governance, but also questions related to rules on procurement, environmental safeguards, all the sort of key attributes that are building blocks of a Bretton Woods-like financial institution. So we're in conversations with the Chinese. The Australians very usefully sort of produced a non-paper that subsequently became public with lots of questions, very useful, important questions. And we're in discussions with the Chinese about these very questions. So this notion that the U.S. and Australia and other allies are somehow intrinsically and reflexively opposed to this because it's a Chinese initiative is simply incorrect. We think it's a interesting idea, and we're in constant conversation with the Chinese about how to make it a truly multilateral institution that reflects the rules of similar institutions.
Thank you. That's a nice segue into some of the security issues, I think, because there's, we talk a lot about how strong and deep the alliance is, but I'd just like to throw out a few numbers from some polling in Australia, and Andrew, from your old institution, the Lowy Institute, but also some other polls, and it's very clear that support for the alliance is very strong. In 2013, 82% said the alliance is very important for Australia's security. There was a firm majority for basing U.S. forces in Australia at the Darwin sort of rotation, and that went up, 61% in 2013, up from 55% in 2011. But on the other hand, when you sort of dig into the numbers on various contingencies, support is a little bit lower. Preparedness to support the U.S. in the Middle East, only 48% agreed. And in Asia, in the contingency of a conflict between China and Japan and the East China Sea, there was even less support, 38% agreed. And another poll showed that in a China-Japan contingency, 71% of Australians wanted to remain neutral, thought that Australia should remain neutral between the U.S. and China in that situation. And so there is this, because of China's sort of very important, economic influence, sometimes it's easier, it seems, on the global issues that there's more sort of a deeper public support, but on some of the regional contingencies, it's a little trickier. And of course, there's a debate in Australia on, I think sometimes it's overblown, but on the alliance, I mean, you have some leading figures from previous governments criticizing the alliance and some scholars. So my question really is, Andrew, how should we think about this sort of debate in Australia? I mean, how, if we look over a 5 to 10 year period with all of the different crises and problems that are likely to arise, we don't know what they are, but we're pretty sure there'll be some. Is this something we should be concerned about, or is this just, something that will be easily sort of manageable given sort of the context of the particular problems as they arise?
Look, I think the starting point, Tom, is that there is incredibly strong public support for the alliance in Australia. And I think at a kind of instinctive level, Australians understand the value of the alliance. Whether or not they sort of conceptualise it, I think there's just a very powerful, deep-seated sense of comfort with the alliance publicly, and I personally take a lot of comfort from that. There is an elite debate in Australia about the alliance. I don't think that's particularly surprising. If you look at American alliances around the world, they haven't been free of controversy. So I think it's understandable and legitimate that there should be debate about the alliance. And I think, in fact, that's probably a healthy thing because it's so profoundly important that in any open society, these things should be the subject of debate. On the polling, I'm a little bit suspicious of questions asked about certain contingencies, hypotheticals, without any context whatsoever. Would you support Australia? Would you support the United States in a conflict over X? Well, what conflict? How did it arise? Over what period? Was the build up? Who does international opinion generally hold to be accountable? I think without those sort of layers of context, some of that polling, is a little dubious, I have to say. In terms of this kind of debate about the choice, I find it a little silly, really. I might have said this to Evan yesterday, but we hosted the G20 late last year, and on one day we had a huge photograph on the front of our newspapers of President Obama, Prime Minister Abbott and Prime Minister Abe shaking hands in front of the three national flags. And then the following day, there's a huge photograph of President Xi Jinping and Prime Minister Abbott signing our free trade agreement with China. So evidently it is possible to have very strong alliance relationship with the United States, a growing strategic and economic partnership with Japan, and a very productive, mutually beneficial, broad-based relationship with China also. So this debate, it won't finish just because I've pronounced on it now, unfortunately. There'll be more twists and turns, and doubtless, you know, there'll be future controversies about the alliance. But as I say, when something's so fundamental to your public policy, it's unsurprising it would be a subject of discussion.
Thanks. Evan, if I could ask you a slightly a version of that question. I mean, you've spoken here today, but also previously, about the importance of alliances, and not just the particular alliances, you know, but also conceptually, like why this sort of makes sense in the modern world and they aren't just Cold War relics. But when you go back to the, you know, Cold War, to the general literature and alliances, the fear that one partner may get dragged in to a conflict because that's more important to the other is sort of a recurring theme in the debate, and it's constantly sort of brought up. Well, usually it's framed in hypotheticals, and usually it doesn't happen, but it is one of those main arguments that people use against the alliances. So as one of sort of the architects of sort of the contemporary alliance system in Asia, what would you say to an Australian sort of critic of the alliance who said, you know, we can't get dragged into this sort of East China Sea dispute, or, you know, we need to be worried about, you know, balancing our relations with China with those of the US? Like, what's sort of the argument that you would deploy? Yes.
Thanks. It's an interesting question. First, I'm happy to say we've never had that conversation. There's never been such a high level of anxiety in Australia that they're worried that the U.S. is going to make some irresponsible decision that would drag them into war. So I'm happy to admit that here to date, we haven't had that conversation. Number two, I would say that constant communication is essential. It's important in alliance management to have very clear expectations on both sides about what the other wants to do within the alliance and the other's sort of regional strategies. And that's especially important in sort of the information age with lots of commentary out there. Because if you were just looking at the U.S.-Australia alliance through the debates that Andrew talked about, you'd probably be pretty concerned. But for those of us sort of in the belly of the beast, so to speak, it's not even remotely like that. And as Andrew said, this notion that there's a choice is I think it's even sillier than he thinks, because we've never, ever, we would never want to put any of our alliance partners in a situation where they have to make a choice. And that applies throughout the region, especially between the United States and China. That is not an effective strategy. I firmly believe with the final point that Andrew made, which is we think our alliances are completely and totally consistent with countries in the region having stable and productive economic, security, diplomatic relationships with China. And the images that Andrew pointed to comparing our Trilat with their FTA, I just think is an interesting, useful, recent example of how it's possible to strike that balance. The United States, has done the same. If you look at our relations with Japan, the ROK, and Australia under the Obama administration, I think that you've seen just as much progress in those as we've had in the U.S.-China relationship. So I think you can do both at the same time. But communication, expectations, they're essential.
Great. Thank you. We'll throw it open to the audience in a minute. Just one or two other questions, and on Southeast Asia and the South China Sea, there's some, you know, obviously we saw last year, but also previously, what the Philippines have called sort of the China's sort of creeping invasion or creating facts on the ground, in facts in the sea, I guess, in the South China Sea, in terms of more assertive policy. This arises in the alliance in terms of Australia has is in a different place, obviously, than the US. The US has, I think, pushed back quite strong against that, particularly in the early part of 2014. Is that something, the sort of US sort of response, is that something that Australia would sort of be very much a part of, or how is this seen, how is this debate and how is this challenge and how is that dimension of the China challenge perceived from an Australian perspective?
So Australia's a trade-dependent economy, very heavily trade-dependent economy, and 60% of our exports go through the South China Sea. So we don't have a territorial claim, I hasten to add, but we have a profound interest in freedom of navigation through that vital waterway. And we also have a huge interest in stability in the region, because, obvious point, but, you know, over half a century of startling economic growth in the region has depended on stability, and every country in the region, US, China, everyone else, has a massive interest in that situation continuing, so that we can continue to benefit our communities and generate growth and jobs. So we have profound interest there. We don't take a side in the territorial disputes, but we watch it extremely carefully. We're in very constant contact with the US and other countries, and above all, what we want to see is a continuation of freedom of navigation in those waters. And I don't actually think there is a difference, or certainly not a profound difference, in our approaches to this. You know, we make clear our commitment to freedom of navigation and disputes being resolved peacefully in accordance with international law. So I think our positions are pretty well aligned, and we will continue to work together very closely to ensure that there aren't miscalculations or something in the worst eventuality, conflict in that region.
So let me just add on to Andrew's point, because I agree with everything that he said, and I think one interesting way in which, or an interesting example explains how the alliance is very practical in dealing with security challenges is, you know, I share Andrew's concerns about developments in the South China Sea. Obviously, instability or conflict is not in either of our interests. The question is, how do you deal with it? It's a serious challenge, and it's one that we are in constant contact about. There are a variety of different elements of our strategy to respond, but one of them is working with countries in the region, both claimants and non-claimants, to make sure that they have sufficient civilian maritime capabilities, specifically Coast Guard capabilities, to understand what's happening in their maritime littoral and to protect them. And that's a useful and important strategy, but it's a real challenge. It's a long-term challenge, because you're talking about building partner capacity. And, you know, it's something that takes time. But Australia had a very significant success in the Pacific Islands with your Pacific Patrol Boat program of doing this very thing, admittedly on a smaller scale than we're looking at in the South China Sea. But that's an example how, in our conversations, they came to us and said, hey, we had this really interesting experience. This is what worked well. This is what didn't. And then we began talking about how to apply that to countries like the Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia, and how we can work both in parallel and also in overlapping ways to improve the maritime domain awareness of countries. So that's just sort of a practical example of how a very high-quality alliance can allow us to address that kind of challenge.
Thank you. Final question before we throw it open to the audience on Southeast Asia. So, you know, Australia, I think if you ask people what the main sort of national security issues are, you know, a lot of them are very local, very regional, whether it's, you know, relations with Indonesia or Papua New Guinea or the refugee issue. Andrew, as you sort of look at your country's regional strategy and some of those sort of immediate problems that you face, what's the role of the alliance you know, if any, in dealing with those issues?
I think this is an area where Australia's general view, and I think it's a fairly long-standing view, has been that in terms of our immediate region, this is an area where the United States actually expects us to lead and to provide perhaps the majority of the public goods, to focus our development assistance efforts, to focus our security cooperation efforts. And I think that's an entirely legitimate expectation, by the way. So this is an area where actually I think our, you know, the way the alliance works is this is an example of burden sharing, particularly when it comes to the South Pacific. We coordinate closely and we cooperate closely, but we have a particular focus, obviously, on those countries and their stability and their prosperity. So I think that's the way we'd tend to look at it through the alliance.
Evan, care to comment on Australia?
No, I think Andrew said it very nicely.
Okay, great. Well, we'll throw it open to the audience. So we'll take we'll go Chris Nelson first, and then we'll go here and over here. We'll take three at a time. So.
Thanks so much, Tom. Great discussion. Evan, 6 years and your hair hasn't turned white. How is that possible? And thank you so much for all the economic discussion. It means I don't have to ask about it, but I will quote it tonight. Bates, in his introduction, talked about Australia as a major alliance in the region. And in your remarks, Evan, you talked about working with Japan, the trilateral with U.S., Australia, Japan. It would be great if you could expand a bit on what your hopes and expectations are for working with the Abe administration over the next year or so on these issues, particularly, you know, given the 70th anniversary and all the things that are happening. And that's a segue into my second part, so I apologize. Abe-san was just in Canberra fairly recently and gave a very well-received speech, as far as we could see, that was very interesting. In particular, because he specified some historical incidents that are, you know, famous or infamous and still very painful for Australians. And we know that Abe wants to come to the U.S. this year and undoubtedly will give a speech. From your experience of how his speech in Canberra was received, do you have any thoughts or suggestions as to what Abe should say when he gets here, and should he get into history? And, obviously a possible hornet's nest, but it seemed to work with you guys. So I think that helps segue back to the question, Evan, about expectations of working in, trilaterally with Japan on strategic issues, especially vis-a-vis China, especially the Senkakus and things like that. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Gentleman behind you there. Yeah, and if you could introduce yourself and then ask a question.
John Zan with CTI TV of Taiwan. I have a question for Evan. What is your comment of the current status of relations between the United States and Taiwan, particularly in the context of Zhu Lilun taking over from Ma Ying-jeou as the KMT chair and Chairwoman Tsai Ing-wen of the DPP forming a task force to study and work out a new mainland policy that would probably address some of the U.S. concerns? For Andrew, could you also comment on the Australian-Taiwan relations? Thank you.
Okay, and we'll do one more just over the gentleman over here. If you could pass the mic along the rope, maybe. Yeah.
Hi, Scott Harold from the RAND Corporation. Tom, thank you very much. Evan, you touched on challenges that the U.S. seeks to respond to in cooperation with Australia. I may have misheard you. I thought you mentioned the rise of China and the rise of India. As we've known, India is a cooperative partner. It's a core piece of the rebalance to Asia. So I wondered if you could expand on how you see working with the Australians to shape the positive emergence of India, and just to clarify the way in which the Obama administration is viewing India. For Mr. Shearer, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how the deeper relationship between Canberra and Tokyo and the deepening relationship between Canberra and New Delhi is unfolding, and how you all see managing that so that the Chinese, which may perceive an effort to reinvigorate a security diamond or an arc of democracies and freedom, might not respond to it in that context, but might see it as a positive force. Thank you.
Thank you. Three great questions. Usually when you ask for three questions, it's because in any set of three, one or two, you know, are sort of vague and don't really bring anything up. And so if you package them together, you definitely get one. But we have Japan, Taiwan, and India, which could be a session all, they all could be a session all of their own. So if we just start and you want to talk about whichever you choose, and if you miss anything, then I'll come back. So Evan, do you want to begin?
Sure.
You could do Australia, Taiwan.
Yeah, exactly. I'll do Australia, Taiwan. So Chris, thanks for all you do. Thanks for your great newsletter every day. On Japan, look, the U.S.-Japan relationship is in great shape. Abe has been a great partner with the president. They've met numerous times, talk on the phone a lot. President called him, as you know, right after he won the latest election. It was one of the best phone calls they've had. Look, we've got a really robust agenda with Japan in 2015. Number one, we got to get TPP done. The last big market access negotiation is with Japan. It's hard because anything important between two large economies is hard to do, but we're in the end game, and now is the time to get it done. Number two, we have to complete the process of revising our defense guidelines. Given the historic decision on collective self-defense last year by the Abe administration, that's provided more space for us to think about the roles and missions of the U.S.-Japan alliance and the ways in which we can work together on meeting both regional challenges and even global challenges. So we need to finish that process, and we're working really hard on doing that. In terms of Japan's relationship with the region, you know, we thought that Prime Minister Abe's January 5th speech, in which he addressed history issues, was very important and significant, and his statements in it, I think, provided a very useful signal of how he and Japan are going to address history issues in this important year. So we warmly welcome the statements that he made, and you know, we hope that that's realized throughout the year, because what we would like is a Japan that is influential, credible, active, and a strong partner with the United States in the Asia-Pacific and globally. And only by effectively addressing history issues, by promoting healing, will, I think, we achieve that kind of Japan, and they will find a very, very close partner in the United States. Let's see, John, on your question about U.S.-Taiwan relations, what I would say is, I mean, you know, we have an unofficial relationship with Taiwan. It's something that I've worked on very closely since day one at the NSC. And within that framework of an unofficial relationship, we want to have you know, a very robust and productive relationship with the government. You know, that's something that we work on, you know, every day. It's, you know, we've just gone through a difficult period. Hopefully we can move past it. Nobody likes being taken for granted. You know, the fundamentals of the U.S.-Taiwan relationship, I think, are solid. On the last question, and Scott, your question about India, because the president's going to India later this week, you know, I'm not going to talk in great detail about it, but one important aspect of our relationship with India and what the president's going to do is talking more with Prime Minister Modi about his shift from the look east to an act east policy, and we're looking very seriously at ways in which the U.S. and India can work more together in the Asia Pacific on, you know, a full range of issues within Asia-Pacific institutions, on challenges like maritime security, what are India's perspectives, where does India think it can make a contribution, and then, of course, we're, you know, pursuing India's role in interesting aspects of architecture. As you know, we have a U.S.-India-Japan trilateral dialogue. Let's see what more we can do there, and we're looking at, you know, other options as well. So over to you, Andrew.
Thanks, Evan. I mean, just starting out on Japan and history, I think it's profoundly instructive that the Australia-Japan relationship, which has been absolutely critical for the region when you think about it. I mean, Australia's minerals and energy exports to Japan over more than half a century really fueled the Japanese economic miracle that sort of kick-started the whole East Asia growth miracle. This is a fundamentally important relationship for both countries. That economic relationship dates back to 1957, so right under the shadow of the Second World War, a particularly far-sighted Australian government reached out to Japan and put in place a commerce agreement. And all of everything that's flowed from that is based on that very raw decision by both countries to deal with history in a forward-looking, practical way. And I think that's instructive. Australia welcomes Japan playing a more active role in security regionally and globally. We think Japan's been an exemplary international citizen for more than half a century, and we're putting increasing weight on our strategic relationship with Japan. We think this is critical. We think it's in the interests of the region more widely as well as both our countries, and we'll continue to work at that. Just on India, I mean, I don't really accept the premise that a stronger Australia-India relationship, including a strategic relationship, should cause problems for anyone. After all, we're Indian Ocean littoral neighbours, and I think the it's broadly accepted on both sides of that relationship that it's an underdeveloped relationship. And Prime Minister Modi made a very important bilateral visit to Australia in the margins of the G20, and that I think is going to kickstart a new phase in Australia's strategic dealings with India, and I think that's very welcome. And again, I think it's something that that our other partners around the region will strongly welcome. And on Taiwan, I can really only echo Evan's comments. I mean, for Australia, Taiwan is and will remain a very important economic partner. And we look forward to continuing that important relationship.
Okay, great. So the gentleman in the middle. Yeah.
Stanley Roth, Boeing. Given your national security portfolios, I'd like to ask you a kind of specific national security question. What do you see as the greatest threat to your national security in the short term? What keeps you up tonight? And then, taking, I don't know if you call it middle term or long term, 5 to 10 years, what do you imagine would be your greatest national security concern, threat? And I'm talking about in a traditional sense, not the strength of your economies or ability to deal with climate change or things like that, but in traditional security threats. And then how do you see the alliance, which has been the focus up to this point of this conference, helping you in dealing with those threats?
Thank you. Maria Solis there against the wall. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Mireya Solis from Brookings. I want to go back to trade policy, if I may. I thought it was really interesting that President Obama chose to frame the issue as one of competition between the United States and China to devise rules for the 21st century economy. And I agree with the stagnation of the multilateral trading system. We are in a situation of decentralized competition, and any abdication of U.S. leadership would in fact result in others writing the rules of the game. However, I do see a downside, and this is where my question comes into play, in the sense that one of the biggest misunderstandings, I believe, surrounding the TPP as part of the rebalance strategy has been that this is an attempt to highlight rivalry, to exclude China, if you will, to contain China. I've long argued that it's the opposite, really, what's at stake with the TPP. It's an inducement strategy to try to bring China on board with these 21st century rules. So my question is for Evan. how you calibrate the message to your Chinese counterparts and other interested parties in the TPP when you highlight competition with China, how you make them realize it's about constructed competition, race to the top, and not an attempt at stressing rivalry and exclusion. And if you would care to comment also on China's initiative in the APEC summit regarding moving to the front burner, the free trade area of the Asia Pacific. Thank you.
You. And then the first person that catch my eye was at the, very close to the door. So that gentleman there, yeah.
Good morning. I'm Scott Morgan. I'm president of Red Eagle Enterprises. Concerning Asia and Pacific, right now, one country we seem to be overlooking is South Korea. So how do we make sure we're engaged in South Korea so that we don't give people the opportunity to take advantage, so that the mistake of 1950 is not repeated again, where they're attacked by outsiders? And second, regarding maritime security and other, and working on terrorism, with recent events in the western part of the Indian Ocean area of Yemen and Somalia, so how will we see future Australian cooperation with the U.S. in that part of the region, or the world? Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Andrew, why don't we start with you on this occasion?
Threats that keep me up at night, Stan. I think you'll probably all appreciate it if I say that the main one for me, you know, today is domestic terrorism, and in particular this new manifestation of terrorism, the kind of lone wolf, single actor, small, autonomously radicalized actor. We've got a pretty high exposure to the whole sort of foreign terrorist fighter problem. I think there's upward of 70 Australians involved in fighting across Iraq and Syria. A number have returned home, and those are the ones we know about. And we just know from our previous experience with Afghanistan and returning foreign fighters, many of whom subsequently became involved in domestic terrorism, that this is a profoundly dangerous situation, and one which is getting a massive amount of attention from us. We've revamped all our counter-terrorism legislation over the last several months. We've given a sizable boost in funding to our intelligence and security agencies, and you know, despite those things, which are all important things to have done, I think we're still, you know, very concerned about this, and like governments right around the world, particularly in Europe recently, but Canada as well, obviously, really grappling with this terrible problem and trying to understand it and do absolutely everything we can. So I think that's the immediate thing that keeps me up. Medium term, I mean, one of the lessons I draw from last year, where we found ourselves, you know, if 2 years ago you'd said, do you think Australia will have troops in Iraq again? And do you think that Australia will conduct a large police intervention in eastern Ukraine? you know, someone would have thought you were mad. So medium term, you know, who knows? I think the real lesson here is you kind of have to be ready for just about everything. I think our longer-term work in the alliance to shape is incredibly important in terms of the region. But I think we're also seeing, you know, right across the Middle East and parts of Africa, you know, some of the terrible costs of failing and failed states, and that these security threats that seem over there and sort of, you know, maybe you can ignore them and maybe our publics would like to ignore them, but I think we've just been reminded again recently that these threats are not distant.
Thanks. Evan?
So I have a slightly different answer than Andrew because my portfolio is more narrow. So you know, I'm just worried about the Asia Pacific. He has all of Australian national security to be concerned about. So I would say over the short term, my immediate concern would be an accident or a miscalculation among or between major regional militaries. So that could be the United States and China. That could be Japan or China. That sort of spirals out of control. That could sort of fundamentally change the security environment in the region. It would not be in the U.S. interests for either one or any variation of a major military accident or miscalculation to happen, because I think that that would take the Asia-Pacific security order in a very negative direction. And so our policies are very much oriented toward avoiding something like that. In the U.S.-China relationship, we're working on confidence-building measures. We concluded a very significant one, surface-to-surface, between the U.S. and China during the president's trip, and now we're working on a second one, air-to-air. These are critical. It's important that the U.S. and China develop rules of the road about how our militaries are going to interact, because it is simply inevitable that our militaries are going to come into greater contact with one another. And we hope that once we get that U.S.-China framework in place, that China sort of applies similar rules to its interactions with other regional militaries. So related to that, one of the other initiatives that we pursued since 2012, when there was sort of an uptick in tensions between China and Japan, is pushing both sides to develop crisis management mechanisms, channels of communication. And I was glad to see that just last week, China and Japan resumed those discussions. Just this week, I believe they're resuming high-level discussions on maritime issues. These are important initiatives. Communication channels across bureaucracies, especially between militaries, need to be wide open in order to avoid accidents or miscalculation. Over the long term, Stanley, what I worry about is any country in the region sort of making the wrong strategic decisions about how to accomplish how to advance their economic or security interests. Them deciding that this sort of, you know, internationalist multilateral system doesn't really serve their interests, and they try to frustrate it, short-circuit it, build a parallel system, or decide that intimidation or coercion is sort of a better way to get things done. Because, you know, if you're big or if you're powerful or if you're both, you can sort of push your weight around. And I mean sincerely that there are a variety of countries in the region that, it's important work in concert with us to build the kind of international order that Andrew and I talked about today. And that's why the fact that we are so closely aligned in that vision for the Asia Pacific is important, because it means that both our countries are talking with all the big players throughout the region to ensure that this vision of regional order is one that continues to be the dominant one.
And on TPP?
TPP, it's a great question. There's no simple answer. Calibrating messages is art, not science. It's something that I've learned a lot about moving from the think tank world to the government world. And the question, it's an excellent question, and what it highlights is one of the inherent tensions that we face in China or really in Asia policy, which is when the United States speaks, we speak to multiple audiences at the same time. At a minimum, there are at least three audiences. There's the domestic American audience, and of course you can break that up into different stakeholders. There's the China audience, which has a very particular set of concerns and lenses of perception that they view the United States through. And then there's the sort of broader Asia region and our Asian allies. And it's a difficult thing whenever the president speaks or any senior officials speak to have a message that resonates with everybody simultaneously. And sometimes it just doesn't work. And sometimes what you have to do is you have to focus more on sequential messages as opposed to simultaneous messages. It's one of the one of the skills you develop over time in the policymaking world. So on the question of TPP and TPA, we've had extensive conversations with the Chinese, about TPP. What is it all about? What do we mean by high standards? As you know, publicly, we've welcomed China to join TPP. In fact, we've publicly welcomed many countries to join TPP if they're willing to meet the high standards. I think the Chinese view on TPP has shifted over time. It originally, in 2011, when the initiative was highlighted, was seen as anti-China. I think many Chinese have come around to recognizing that TPP could be a very useful external force in encouraging additional structural changes in the Chinese economy, similar to the role that WTO played. So we're talking with the Chinese about those attributes of TPP. And I think that there is a clear understanding in Beijing. It's evolved over time about what TPP is and what TPP isn't.
Thank you. I think we have time for just one or two very short sort of questions. So the gentleman there at the back, yeah, beside the microphone, and then the lady one or two rows up just afterwards. Okay.
Thank you. Dong Huiyu with China Review News Agency of Hong Kong. My question for Evan is, you mentioned that U.S., China, Australia held a military survival training. I'm wondering if this kind of training could be expanded to a broader and a bigger military exercise between U.S., China, and Australia. For Mr. Schiller is, if Australia is more willing to play a bigger role in promoting the trilateral military relations in this regard. Thank you.
Thank you. And then the final question, just the lady right beside. Yeah.
Hi, Nadia Chow with the Liberty Times. I have a question for Mr. Scherer. Since you mentioned Taiwan and Australia has an economic relation which Australia treasures, I wonder, do you expect a free trade agreement between Australia and Taiwan as possible? Another question is, how Australia dealing with the Muslim community? One thing I'm interested to know, I think that's a challenging for many country right now. For Evan, just quick question, which you haven't answered, John's, earlier question. For the cross-strait relations with the, possible new leaders from both the opposition party and the ruling party, do you see there is any challenging for the U.S. side or any expectation that the stability and the peace can still be maintained? Thank you.
Thank you. Guys, if you want to address those, but also any sort of closing comments you'd like to make, anything that came up earlier in the conversation that you'd like to go back to, and then we'll finish up. Andrew, if we might start with you.
Sure. Well, just on the question of trilateral military exercises, I mean, we're very open to building on the start that we've already made with these survival exercises. These exercises are a way of getting our militaries getting to know each other, understanding how we operate. Another good example, by the way, is the cooperation to find MH370, where we worked with the Chinese military, South Korean military, Japanese, US. All of these examples of working together are valuable. So we're very open to building on that exercise. And the rotating US Marine presence in Northern Australia is important here because one of the opportunities that presents is greater multilateral opportunities to work together with a whole range of regional countries in humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, maritime surveillance, lots of different fields. So we're definitely open to building on that. In terms of free trade agreements, I think Australia's just kind of recovering from the effort of concluding free trade agreements with our three largest export markets. The next cab off the rank, as it were, in terms of free trade agreements, I would say is TPP, which, as we've discussed, is a big priority, and then probably our negotiations with India, which have got a sort of renewed burst of energy following Prime Minister Modi's visit. Lastly, on the question of engagement with the Islamic community in Australia, it's a really good question. This is absolutely fundamental. I mean, the overwhelming majority of Muslims in Australia are tolerant and incredibly valuable contributors to our society. And one of the key elements of our response to this problem has to be reaching out to people in that community. Frankly, one of the huge challenges we have is connecting with many of the people who are most vulnerable to this phenomenon. They tend to be very young, increasingly young, teenagers, disturbingly, and the kind of the established structures for engaging with those communities are not terribly adroit at reaching out to those people who tend to be living in a different world, frankly, on social media. And there are multiple stories of these kids telling their mother that they're just off to the shopping mall, and that, you know, the next thing the family hears a week later is that they're in Syria. You know, absolutely appalling story. So hugely important issue, and something that we're going to be putting a lot of effort into.
Evan, any closing comments, either in relation to the questions or just generally?
Well, on the first issue of trilateral security cooperation, I agree with Andrew. We'll have to take a look at it, see what's appropriate, but, you know, we're off to a good start. You know, on the Taiwan questions, cross-strait relations and cross-strait stability are an important component of the U.S.-Taiwan relationship, and it's important to us, to the United States, that cross-strait stability, both sides invest in cross-strait stability to the extent possible, and we're very impressed with the strides that have been made in recent years, that communication channels have been open, and we hope that the progress that we've seen continues in the future. On the U.S.-Australia relationship, let me just end by thanking Brookings, the U.S. Studies Center. This has been a great conversation. I think it tabled a whole variety of issues. Hopefully, Andrew and I were able to impart to you the sort of the big, broad agenda in the U.S.-Australia relationship, the fact that it's being handled exceptionally well, the quality of our cooperation. I mean, just what we're doing in Iraq against ISIL is an example of that. But, you know, we see that across the board. And this is very much a working relationship in the sense of it's, you know, part of my day-to-day work at the NSC is making sure that we are lashed up with Australia, seeking their opinions, seeking their perspectives, and making sure that we're both moving in the right direction in the Asia-Pacific and elsewhere. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And I'd like to thank both you and Andrew. I think that it's a great testament to the relationship and the alliance that you both took so much time out of your very busy days to be with us for an hour and a quarter here this morning. So thank you, and thank you for your comments earlier, which were very insightful and I think set the stage for the continuing conversations during the day. What we're going to do now is we're going to break for 15 minutes, and then we'll reconvene back here with a panel looking at the strategic and economic environment in the Asia-Pacific and for the alliance. And then we will have a short break for lunch, which will be served just outside. And then we welcome the Australian Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, at 12:30. So with that, we're briefly adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm Kenneth Lieberthal. I'm a senior fellow in the foreign policy program, not born or raised in Australia, but have loved visiting there when I've had the opportunity to do so, and have been the director of the China Center at the Brookings Institution. This panel is going to be picking up many of the themes that were covered in that extraordinarily wide-ranging and, I thought, very informative discussion that we just had in the last panel. Let me introduce our panelists. First, Ambassador Jeff Bleich. He was U.S. Ambassador to Australia for 2009 to 2013. He's a former special counsel to President Obama and still is an advisor to the White House on national security matters. He is also a partner at Munger, Tolles, and Olson, focused especially on Silicon Valley trade and investment in Asia. To Ambassador Bleich's left, Andrew Stoller is an independent consultant on international trade and investment issues based in Adelaide, where he founded the University of Adelaide's Institute of International Trade. Earlier, he spent a number of years in the U.S. Trade Representative's office, and in 1999 to 2002, I believe, was Deputy Director General of the World Trade Organization. Linda Jakobsen has been an independent researcher for about a year, but still retains several affiliations. She's a visiting professor at the U.S. Studies Center at the University of Sydney, a non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute in Sydney, and founding director of a new not-for-profit entity, China Matters. I got to know her years ago as she spent about 22 years living and working in China, mostly researching China's foreign and security policy. And finally, Tom Harley is non-executive chairman of Dow Chemical Australia, joint managing director of the country risk advisory Dragoman. He is chairman of the Liberal Party's think tank, the Menzies Research Center. And prior to establishing Dragoman in 2010, he was president of corporate development at BHP Billiton. I want to note, before we get into the substantive issues, that each of the speakers will be making comments in their personal capacity. They are not representing their current institutions as they engage in this discussion. Let me first raise one broad question to each of our panelists, and I'll go down in order. Invite you to spend perhaps 5 minutes or so to lay out your thinking on that, and then we'll have an opportunity to discuss among ourselves and finally turn to the audience for questions. First, Jeff, in the last panel there was some discussion of the sharp shift from 2009-2010, when the U.S. was both in the depths of the financial crisis and largely blamed globally for being a major source of that crisis. And China rolled out a stimulus program in 2010 that was, kept growth rates going very dramatically. Now China's economy is slowing down quite a bit as it tries a difficult transition. And the U.S. economy really stands out among the industrial economies of the world at this point, much more dynamic. We seem to have bounced back quite effectively. How has this, especially on the U.S. side, this economic rebound impacted Australian views about the dynamics of the alliance, reliability of the alliance, however you want to run with that broad subject?
Well, it's really a bad thing. It's rarely a bad thing for your alliance partner to become wealthier. And so I think the economic gains for the United States has certainly been helpful in terms of advancing alliance goals in a number of different ways. I mean, first, it just means that you have more capability to invest and devote to the alliance and in the region. Secondly, it makes long-term planning easier because you can see a rising trajectory. I think more and more we've appreciated that our security arrangements depend upon strong economic engagement as well. It's not just about the military capability or the security capability. It's about, trading in the region, investing in the region, building those deep relationships in the region economically that gives you some of your security ballast. So it's obviously a positive thing. Probably the best way to approach your question is to do what you did. Go back to 2009 and see where the shift has been in terms of thinking among Australians. Because in 2009, and, I see Ambassador McCallum there, and I know he remembers this period well, and others in the room. But at that point, the support for the U.S. alliance among Australians was still generally strong. notwithstanding the global financial crisis, notwithstanding the unpopularity of the war in Iraq and a number of other things. But it was softer than it is today by a significant measure. The Lowy polling said about 64% of Australians thought that the U.S. alliance was essential to Australia's security. And if you unpack where the weakness was, it was largely among people under the age of 30, because their frame of reference was more limited, and they, their sense of American economic leadership was a global financial crisis, and our economy was on the verge of a cliff at that point. And their view of our security leadership was the Iraq War, which was very unpopular at the time, particularly among people under the age of 30. And so the question was, is this a good alliance for us, particularly if the U.S. is going to have to withdraw and be in an economic decline and have to focus inward, not be able to invest in Asia at the same time that China is rising. And so you had, while the policy-making apparatus, while the people in charge of government institutions were still very much committed to the alliance, you saw this sort of softening in public support among younger people. And also you started to hear more of an elite debate that said maybe we need to hedge, maybe we need to focus more on China, maybe we need to anticipate a sustained period of American decline. And that was the narrative in 2009. If you look at where we are between 2009 and today, Dow was at 6,500 in 2009. It's 17,500, flirting with 18,000 today. Unemployment was 10.2%. It's down to 5.6%. The U.S. was in a recession, looking at the potential even of a depression. We've had sustained growth every quarter, since the first quarter of 2010. So, four full years of continuous growth. We've had, and today we're the most competitive economy in the world and the fastest growing economy in the OECD. So in every dimension, it's been a dramatic turnaround. And in terms of confidence among Australians in the U.S. Economy, it's had all the expected effects. I remember when I was there, the former foreign minister, Bob Carr, used to say, the U.S. is only one budget deal away from dispelling all notions of an economic decline. And I think we proved that we didn't even need to get a budget deal. And so there's real confidence in the resilience of the U.S. economy, even with political dysfunction, to rebound. And that's had all sorts of great knock-on effects. And I'll just mention three for now. One is we had talked about this Asia rebalance, and now you see real things being put into place that are consistent with that. So, for example, last June, we signed an agreement which sort of secures the continued expansion, growth, use of training areas in northern Australia, in Darwin, for joint operations, rotational force of Marines. We've put more money into the airfield cooperation in that same region at Tyndall. In the most recent Osmonds, we've made commitments on satellites. We've made commitments in cyber. We've made commitments in terms of naval cooperation. All of these things reflect greater confidence, greater commitment, greater belief in terms of the security elements. In terms of the economic focus, which is strengthening our security relationship through greater trade and greater integration of the economies there, the commitment on TPP has gone from, in 2009, it was, Doha's dead and this looks like a pretty small potatoes trade agreement, to now recognizing the TPP is the big game in the world, that over 40% of the world's GDP is going to be locked up in it, that it is critical, that you've got the President of the United States highlighting it in the State of the Union address, and that we're going to get across that finish line. I think next year you're going to see the United States both give the President TPA, and I would predict that you're going to see TPP the final deals worked out with Japan and the parties signing on to it. I have more confidence now than I ever had, and I always had some confidence about it. So I think those are all reflections of Australia, U.S. feeling good about each other's prospects and it reinvesting, digging in to the alliance. And that's why, as I said earlier, they went from 64% support in the Lowy poll in 2009 to today it's 82%. That's a reflection of real progress.
Thank you very much. Andrew, TPP is crucial. We heard it in the last panel that this is a critical pillar in the rebalance to Asia. We just had Jeff explain its importance in the U.S.-Australian context. Where do we stand on that, to your mind now? Where are the negotiations? How likely is conclusion of an agreement with market access, concessions in Japan, and so forth? And if we do get an agreement, do you think the Australian Parliament is likely to accept it easily? And do you think it will pass in the United States? Is this something that we should be able to count on? And if all of that occurs, what will be the regional impact?
Well, thank you very much, Ken. Those are good questions, and I think we already had a pretty good review of the TPP in the last panel. But there are a couple of points I would make. I'd say that when you come here to Washington and you talk to the negotiators at USTR or people like Evan, you get a pretty positive view, and it sounds like once the market access negotiations with Japan have finally been wrapped up, that everything will fall into place. I hope that's the case, but I have to say, quite honestly, as I said when we had our meeting last year at CSIS, one big problem for somebody like me commenting on a TPP, and I'm a big TPP supporter, but this has been an extraordinarily non-transparent negotiation, so I don't really know if there's something else lurking out there in the background that could create problems. But on the understanding that things are finally close to being wrapped up, I think that's very good news because the TPP is critical. It's critical for the U.S. position in Asia. It's critical economically. And the fact that the President mentioned it in the State of the Union, I think, was good, although, I was listening to him and it almost sounded like this was a way of protecting ourselves against China, which I think is a bad message because we've worked very hard to try to convince the Chinese over the years that this wasn't some sort of effort to contain China, and I hope that won't lead to any problems in the future. I also understand from the discussions we've had here that the prospects look pretty good for the President eventually getting trade promotion authority, and of course trade promotion authority will be necessary if we're ever going to get the TPP approved here in the United States. I think a really good sign this year compared to what happened last year on TPA is that it seems that the White House is now prepared to actually push for it. Last year that clearly wasn't the case, and particularly with the democratically controlled House, democratically controlled Senate, it wasn't going to happen without White House push. So from what I've been told, it sounds like both TPP and TPA should be wrapped up early in 2015, and I certainly hope that's the case, because if they're not, if they drag on, we had a meeting yesterday up in the Senate, if they drag on past the point where the Congress starts to get itself occupied with budgetary questions, then, that's going to be lost in the fog, and that would really be a real shame, because I'm not sure we'd get back to it anytime soon. Now, you asked whether or not there would be any difficulty getting a TPP agreement approved in the Australian Parliament. And again, I have to use the caveat, from what we know about the TPP and think we know about the TPP, I would say that it's highly unlikely that there would be a difficulty getting it approved in the Australian Parliament for a number of reasons. The first of these is that, unlike the United States, Australia already has free trade agreements with all of the TPP participants, with the exception of Peru, Mexico, and Canada. And Australian trade with Peru, Mexico, and Canada
is not really problematic in any way. So I don't think adding them to the mix of FTAs would create any difficulty. Another thing about the TPP, of course, is that Australia, for example, has an FTA with Japan. If you ask an American negotiator about Australia's FTA with Japan, he'll say it's pretty crummy. And it doesn't do as much on agriculture as it should, and that's why the U.S. has been beating the Japanese over the head for the past 6 months or so. So Australia will get a better deal in many of its FTA markets out of an eventual TPP than it has in its existing FTAs. Again, that should make it more attractive to the Australian Parliament. And finally, of course, getting approval in a Westminster system like we've got in Australia is a different kettle of fish from trying to get it approved here in the U.S. because people tend to toe the party line a lot more there than they do here. Now, the prospects for getting it approved here, I like that soundbite that we had in the last panel where somebody from Oregon, one of the congressional members of Oregon, said, one, two, three, four are the things we don't like about this presidential pronouncement. They were all trade-related. We know, I think, that not all Republicans are going to support these new trade initiatives up on the Hill. So a certain number of Democrats are going to be required to come along as well. How many, I don't know, but I think it's going to be more than a handful are going to have to go for this as well. And again, that's one of the reasons why I think having the president and the White House involved is extremely important. Third part of your question was, what will the regional impact be of TPP once it enters into force? And here, I think this is really a very critical point, because TPP is not just about the regional trade agreement. It's symptomatic of an effort by Australia and the United States and everything they've been doing in trade in the past decade to build a new architecture for conducting trade relations, which has been particularly important when you consider the fact that nothing has really happened in the WTO since 1993. I mean, that's how long it's been since we've negotiated something new in the WTO. One of the things that the TPP will do eventually will be to encourage other APEC members, including China, to be part of what Fred Bergsten first cast out as the FTAAP, everybody in the APEC region. It should also undercut what I regard as retrogressive trade efforts, like the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, the ASEAN Plus 6, which is really being run mainly by China and India, and which I can guarantee you won't produce a result that's anything near as ambitious as what everybody's aiming for in the TPP. Plus, it won't include the United States, and it's key that we include the U.S. in this. So there are a lot of psychological reasons. Some interesting facts, I think, also come to light here, and that is that for both Australia and the United States, assuming that the TPP, and in the U.S. case, the agreement with Europe, the TTIP, assuming that they are eventually successful, 73% of Australian exports and 50% of imports will be with its FTA partners. For the United States, it'll be 67% of exports and 61% of imports. And if China is one day a participant in the TPP, and I believe it has to be in order for the TPP to eventually fulfill everything we ask from it, then 75% of American exports and 81% of imports will be with FTA partners, not with people that are traded with just under the rules of the WTO. And what's true for trade is also true for investment. 68% of American investment abroad and 84% of foreign investment in the U.S. will be covered by these deals. And for Australia, the FTAs, assuming TPP success, 43% of foreign direct investment into Australia and 40% of Australian investment overseas will be covered. Now, the reason why that figure is a lot lower for Australia than it is for the U.S. is because the U.S. will have a deal with Europe. Australia may not. But if Australia were eventually to have its own agreement with the Europeans, that number would jump up to about 80 or 85%, because there's so much important European investment there.
One final point I'll make about this new architecture, it's, you know, actually not very much about market access, notwithstanding the stories about, you know, the discussions with the Japanese and some of the others. It's much more about the behind-the-border measures that business cares much more about these days, like regulatory incoherence, investment rules, competition policy, government procurement, environmental protection, provisions for mutual recognition agreements so that professional people who have to have their qualifications recognized can work in different countries. None of these issues are under discussion at the multilateral level. So this really is an alternative, much more progressive exercise. And for somebody who used to be the Deputy Director General of the WTO to say that, you know, I mean, I really believe it. So I think I'll leave it there for now.
Thank you very much. One question I want to come back to with you on is, what about China's eventual prospects for entering the TPP? That's kind of the big carve-out. And you were Deputy Director General of the WTO when we had Chinese accession to the WTO. So
that's
I'll,
right.
I'll want to pick your brain on that in a few minutes. Linda, there was a good discussion in the first session on the potential tensions between Australia's very extensive economic ties with China, its security ties with the United States, and whether these might come into tension and force some sort of difficult decisions on Australia if there are some untoward developments in Asia in the coming few years, kind of the Hugh White scenario for those who follow the debate in Australia. My sense from the responses in the first session was Hugh White overplays the potential tensions here, and that these things are more manageable and less conflictual than some of the discussion has suggested. What are your thoughts on that, and how would you explain that set of issues?
Thank you, Ken. Before I start, I'd just like to also join in thanking the Brookings Institution, the United States Studies Center, and, of course, you, Ken, for moderating. We're in good hands here. Let me start out by reminding us of perhaps something that everyone knows, but we sometimes forget when we think of Australia being a special case. Just about every country in the region is grappling with this dependency on China for prosperity and security on the United States. What I think makes Australia special is the very deep and broad security relationship it does have with the United States. I mean, part of the Five Eyes. Also, the security cooperation is certainly broadening at the moment. There's such a strong support, like we've now heard from many speakers, in Australia for the alliance. That's not the case in a country, for example, like Korea. So in some ways, Australia is a unique example. Even before the FTA with China was agreed upon in November of last year, Australia was the most trade-dependent on China of all the G20 countries. So in that sense, I guess Australia is a bit unique, but I do always want to remind people that everyone in the region is grappling with this same problem. And yes, I would say there is a tension that Australia needs to manage. This tension is growing in part because Xi Jinping, since coming to power 2 years ago, has been extremely active in the region, in the foreign policy and security sphere. I think it's fair to say that he's made it clear that he would like to see Asia governed by Asians and Asian matters decided by Asians. And, of course, Xi Jinping's vision of it is that China will be in the driver's seat. And as I see it, this is making people in Washington, in many capitals around the region, slightly anxious, slightly uneasy. Xi's come out with so many initiatives. We spoke in the morning session about the investment bank, but there's many other ones. There's the Maritime Silk Road Initiative. There's the Asia Security Concept that Xi Jinping has put on the table. So all of these initiatives are sort of changing the dynamics of the region. And, of course, Xi Jinping and his ministers have made it very clear how little China really does like alliances. We had a very hardcore speech at the Shangshan Forum last year by a vice minister. China doesn't look well upon alliances getting stronger and more robust. So, I mean, against this backdrop, I would say the delicate balancing act, which is required of the Australian government, but of so many governments in the region, is bound to continue in importance, and it's going to continue to be a factor which shapes the alliance that Australia has with the United States. Now, having said all that, I do want to point out that this dichotomy or this tension that so many analysts point to should not be seen as this stark black and white scenario. As Foreign Minister Bishop said at this very conference last year, the United States remains Australia's largest investor, so the United States has a stake in Australia's prosperity. It's not only China. And even in the security sphere, as we heard in the first panel, there are some modest steps in security cooperation. And as far as humanitarian assistance and disaster relief is concerned, and I think it is important that there have now been these trilateral exercises, I've said publicly that I advocate that Australia establishes a state-of-the-art regional humanitarian assistance and disaster relief training center in Darwin to kind of demystify Darwin, and this would give the United States, Australia, China, Indonesia the opportunity to explore perhaps a broader security cooperation. So it's really not all black and white. As to the Hugh White question, now I disagree, as the first panel speakers did, with the stark pointed question, does Australia need to choose? But having said that, I do want to say that Hugh White has done Australia a great service. Though I disagree with him, he has put these questions on the table. He's forced Australians to think about them, and I think that's very important. But no, I don't think that Australia has to choose for a number of reasons, and I think they were discussed rather well in the first panel. I'd like to remind people that before becoming National Security Advisor, Andrew Shearer wrote a paper saying that Australia made that choice, actually, if push came to shove, over 60 years ago by entering into the alliance with the United States. But I'd like to end by saying that rather than seeing a choice between the United States and China, I think China views the deepening, broadening cooperation between between Australia and Japan as something that they're deeply concerned about. They worry that Australia might choose Japan over China in, for example, this very sensitive issue of the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands. And so this broadening cooperation in the security sphere, in the strategic sphere between Australia and Japan is a trend, I think, that when we're looking at the region and looking at how the alliance is going to develop, that's really the key issue.
Do you want to elaborate on that just a little bit? What would be your recommendation? Or
so many people in Australia are so focused on the so-called choice, which I don't think is a choice, between China and the United States. And as I think both Evan and Andrew very eloquently explained, there isn't such a great tension there that everyone thinks there is. But during the last couple of years, Australia has taken a number of steps to broaden, to deepen, to become more close to Japan in the security sphere, intelligence sharing, and so on. That really, I think, causes deep anxiety in Beijing. A bilateral alliance is something that they've always had to live with. I think Beijing accepts the very strong alliance relationship between the United States and China, Australia. There's no question about that. But when it then becomes a trilateral, especially as the Chinese tend to see that as perhaps a mechanism with which China is going to be targeted, and that really does cause some anxiety. So that's a trend that I think is worth thinking very deeply about, the triangular relationship as it moves forward.
Thank you, Tom. An issue that hasn't come up today is energy and energy security. This is a rapidly changing environment in the energy world, with energy abundance now, dramatic drop in oil prices, the shale gas revolution. How does energy figure into the U.S.-Australia ties, and what are the impacts of that relationship for Asia more broadly and some of the issues that we've been discussing?
Thank you, Ken. Before I try and answer that, I'd just like to say how pleased Dow is as an inaugural sponsor of Alliance 21 with what it's turned into. And so I'd like to thank all the people who've been involved in organizing it. It's far exceeded our expectations. And I reiterate the disclaimer you made earlier. I'm not speaking on behalf of Dow, what I'm going to say. I'd like to look at the question by using the prism of the LNG industry. And it's very pertinent to the alliance because, in a way, it's the largest economic manifestation of the Australian-US alliance. Over the last 10 years, about $200 billion has been invested in new LNG facilities in Australia. And the largest nationality participating in that is the United States. Chevron, Exxon, Conoco, and Hess are some of the names that come to mind. And these are big investments for them. I think in Chevron's case, Australia would represent its largest single exposure. It's also a significant economic consequences for a lot of service companies, and Bechtel has been one of the largest suppliers, certainly to the Queensland thing. By 2017, Australia will be the largest shipper of LNG in the world, supplying about 50%, but currently it supplies about 50% of Asia's LNG gas needs. So the US investment, a globally significant energy security participant. It underpins the energy supply of Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan, and increasingly China, but very small in China's case today. The whole development was always aimed at Asia, although I want to indulge in an anecdote, if I may. There was a brief period when I was at BHP, we looked at shipping gas to California, and I remember distinctly going with John Howard to visit Arnold Schwarzenegger. None of us had seen any of his films, so we didn't know quite what to expect. And after the meeting, I said, well, he seemed really intelligent, to which John Howard said, either that or he's a good actor. Anyway, we didn't proceed with LNG in California. To come back to the question, I'd like to look at the conditions that underpinned all these investments because it's worth looking at them and the health of those conditions. First of all, why did it come to Australia? Well, I think one of the key reasons was Australia is seen as a secure investment destination, a safe place to put your money. That means, you know, all the rule of law, the constancy of policy. But it was also seen, in another sense, as secure from the customer's point of view. So for Japan to take the decision to hook itself to LNG required a reliability of supply. And that's not just about the companies and their performance, but also the country and their relationship. Second thing is was that is all relative. Australia's security and constancy compared with the competing nations and the competing LNG producers in the region include Russia, the Middle East as a supplier, and Malaysia and Indonesia. The third reason for success was, I think, the quite basic one of the abundance of gas. Australia has an enormous amount of gas, large deposits with long life. And the fourth reason was transport costs, the proximity of Australia to the markets and the lower cost compared with shipping it, for example, from the Middle East. What have been the challenges that have come forward, particularly with the more recent developments? There's a whole host of them that wouldn't be apparent from here, and they're the domestic manifestations of a kind of form of Dutch disease that Australia has suffered. And this is seen in cost overruns because of skilled labour shortages, exploitation of those shortages by some unions, and that has made Australia a relatively uncompetitive place to build future expansions, certainly for the time being. The falls in prices have, combined with the cost overruns, will challenge the returns of many of the major investors in the near term. The earlier contracts for LNG, the North West Shelf, the first major LNG project committed to, are an S-curve. They have a floor and a cap, and they're pegged to a bundle of oil prices. Now, it's not clear, certainly to me, what the current terms are of the new LNG plants, but some are said to be uncapped and unfloored. The companies seeking to enter into these contracts saw high oil prices as an opportunity and gave up the floor. They may be regretting that. Some of these projects overcommitted to gas, and that gas is not available domestically to support some of these plants, so they've committed to gas for which there is not currently supply. And that has a profound domestic consequence in that the price of gas for domestic users is increasing, in some cases, threefold. Now, that has a huge blow for manufacturing industry, particularly in my state, Victoria, where gas penetration is very high. The policy responses for that have been learnt a lot from the US, and the US, this symposium has been very helpful to us in doing that. The way that the US domestic gas market operates has given us a menu of policy measures, which I might come to later, that we're seeking Australian policymakers to apply. The next disruptive thing is floating technologies, and this was largely a positive one. Future gas developments, because of the cost of building things onshore, may increasingly be offshore liquefaction plants. And Shell is building the Prelude plant, which is the first in the world, which will be off Western Australia. But there are also floating receiving plants, and this will enfranchise a new market. If you want to take LNG as your energy supply, you have to commit to building a large receiving terminal that turns the liquid back into gas. Now, that can now be done by ships, and so new countries will perhaps take that up. The lower gas prices, the lower oil prices, will encourage more countries, we believe, to take up LNG. And a greater take-up will lead to greater demand from Australia. I suppose the last point I'd make is the environmental desirability of gas has increased, caused China to increase its gas penetration from currently 5%. Now, that's low. The whole of Asia is 11%. The whole of the world is 30%. The very last concluding point I'd like to make is energy security is significant for both our countries. To look at the fact that we are entirely self-reliant on energy shouldn't blind us to the fact that the countries that we depend on for our markets are not. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me come back, if I can. Well, actually, before I raise any additional questions, let me ask whether you have any additional comments on what you have heard each other say. Jack, please.
I would just emphasize one point that Linda made that often gets lost in the conversation about U.S. arrangements with Australia. People often focus on our security relationship, our common culture, values, approach to the world, rule of law, those sorts of things, but tend to think that the economic relationship has been receding to some extent because we're now the number three trade partner instead of number one trade partner. But the investment relationship, where you really bet on each other, the true measure of commitment to one another economically, has just gone from strength to strength. Right now, I think in terms of foreign direct investment, U.S. investment in Australia is five times that of China. But in terms of bilateral portfolio relationship investment, it's 20 times. It's about $1 trillion. Just staggering. And so when people talk about investment, when they talk about the economic relationship, they're not exaggerating when we say the U.S. is Australia's most important economic partner.
That is true also for Australian investment in the U.S., which is a substantial multiple of Chinese investment in the U.S.
Precisely.
Like 20 times the amount.
Mm-hmm.
Linda?
I just had a follow-on about the dependency and Australia as a politically reliable partner and market. I think something in Australia, people tend to forget that, yes, Australia is very dependent on trade with China. But China sees Australia as extremely important precisely because it is a politically stable country. It has the rule of law. It's a very good test case market where they can train their people in joint ventures and other commercial enterprises. So I think we forget that the dependency, everything is relative, but Australia is not the only partner that needs China. China also needs Australia.
And the Chinese have been substantial investors in the LNG projects.
Yep. Let me come back, if I can, to the TPP discussion. I was a little surprised last night that President Obama framed the argument for TPP in part in terms of having the U.S. quality rules set the international trade environment in the Asia Pacific rather than China's rules. We've, to my knowledge, all along effectively said to the Chinese, for you to come into this negotiation at this point, before the initial agreement is done, would make it too difficult to get to the initial agreement. You're such a large economy, it is you operate in such different ways domestically. But once we get that initial agreement done and that is set up, we will welcome you to apply to join it and negotiate your way in, very much as eventually happened with WTO. Do you think that this is going to be feasible? Do you see China's entering a successful TPP once it is ratified? And also relatedly, how does the TPP relate to this longer-term free trade agreement of the Asia-Pacific region that is now on the longer-term agenda? Is it potentially preemptive, or is it a stepping stone to a broader regional agreement? How do you see this playing out?
Well, I think a lot will depend eventually. I'll come back to some of the specifics, but I think a lot will depend eventually on what the Chinese might want to use the TPP for. Because obviously, I mean, anybody who knows the history of China's accession to the WTO will know that the Chinese leaders wanted to use that accession process to reform things in China. It's much easier to say, we have to do this because they're making us do it, than it is to say, we're doing this because I think we should do it, because then people get into a big argument with it. So even on a question like whatever the rules in the TPP are going to be for SOEs, it might be that the Chinese are at a stage where they want to do something to reform the way the SOEs operate. And if they are, I think it'll make it a lot easier. what worries me about this whole thing is the mechanics of the exercise, because if we're determined to finish, if you know, the negotiators say it has to be a high-quality agreement, and it can only be a high-quality agreement if we don't bring anybody else in at this stage, and that, by the way, is not just China. It's also some other important players in the mix, Korea, Taiwan, you know, Hong Kong. They're not going to be part of TPP-12. So if the answer from the American negotiators and others is, yes, we eventually want the Chinese to come in when they're ready to live by these new rules, what's the procedure going to be? If it's a WTO accession procedure type of thing, I have to say I'm a little worried. Because, you know, it took China 15 years to negotiate its accession to the WTO. And if the Chinese think it's going to take them another 15 painful years to negotiate accession to TPP, I don't think they're going to be very interested in doing it, which I think will be bad news. On the other hand, you know, if you finish the negotiation of the TPP-12 and you say it's not pure accession negotiation, that implies that you're going to revisit some of the things that you negotiated to TPP, which is another difficult prospect from my standpoint. So, you know, I'm worried about how it's going to be handled. And, of course, you know, if China has to negotiate accession, so does Korea, as opposed to being in on the ground floor. I mean, my own feeling is that, you know, eventually if the Chinese want to participate in the TPP, and I want the Chinese to participate in the TPP, it has to be partly because the Chinese want to use the TPP for something internally as well, which would make it a lot easier. But nobody's ever told me what the process is going to be for handling this at some stage.
Well, you know, I think I may be a bit more optimistic about the how TPP ultimately plays out in the region. And in part, it's based on the history. I mean, when this thing started, it was, you know, Malaysia, Brunei, Singapore, Chile, Peru, the U.S. and Australia were really the only two major players in the in terms of, you know, big economies engaged. And now you've added Canada, Mexico. No one thought they would join, and certainly no one thought Japan would join because of the market access issues. So the notion that other economies aren't structured to easily integrate into TPP, we've already overcome those concerns in other cases. China's probably more challenging. But I don't think it's insuperable. I think if you look at how TPP is likely to play out, my sense is that at the very least, what it does is it creates a very strong market with over 40% of the world's GDP that's trading well together. And China and every other nation in the world is going to see that as a valuable market that they would like to be able to play in as well. That means that either China starts looking for ways to, you know, progress its own development of trade relationships to more align with it, and then enter TPP, or develop, you know, some sort of comparable set of trade agreements that even if they are at some point separate, they're still going to be closer to what TPP provides than anything we currently have. And the whole idea is to get countries trading and speaking the same language on some of the critical issues, like, you know, whether it is a market access, but also things like environmental protection, worker rights, you know, IP protection, some of these other elements that allow markets to work smoothly and not gum up.
China recently reached a free trade agreement with Australia, also with South Korea. I've heard Chinese comment that those two agreements are much higher quality than other FTAs that China has done, and that part of the strategy at the top of the Chinese hierarchy was to demonstrate that they do not just do FTA-light kinds of agreements, that they can handle serious agreements. I'm not as familiar as I would like to be with the content of the, say, China-Australia FTA. Does it meet that standard? Does it make you more confident that China could negotiate seriously entry into a TPP agreement and do so credibly?
Well, all the details of the China-Australia agreement are not yet public, but a lot of them are. And I'd say that it, even the skeptics, even those who really would have not banked their money on this agreement being signed so quickly, I mean, not quickly, but that it was, it did actually happen, are surprised at how high a quality it is. So I think it does precisely prove what you're saying, Ken, that the Chinese are capable, when they want to, when there's political will, to conclude a very high-quality agreement. I mean, I'm not an economist, but the Australian economists are saying that this is much higher in quality, the one between Australia and China, than the one between Australia and Japan.
And for what it's worth, I have heard in China for more than a year now that the thinking at the top of the Chinese leadership is that if they, as they watch TPP, they want to be well informed of what's happening in the negotiations. And the thinking very much now is that they can use an accession process precisely the way they used the WTO accession process to try to leverage domestic reforms that would be more difficult to do without this kind of external obligation. We'll have to see how that plays out.
But. As I said, I think that's the only basis on which we're going to get the Chinese and the TPP. Yeah. If the TPP is a high-quality 21st century agreement, will be because the Chinese want to use it for their own purposes domestically as well as everything. They don't really need it. China doesn't really need the TPP for market access purposes. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the, you know, the relative price of goods made in China compared to anywhere else, tariffs aren't very important in the region. So there have to be other incentives for China to come into the new rules-based thing, and I think they have to be internal more than external.
Then we'll have to move on. Yes,
I just wanted to say the Chinese are, I mean, incredibly interested in the TPP. I mean, there are ongoing discussions between lower-level American officials from Commerce every time they go to Beijing to keep the Chinese officials abreast of the developments in TPP. So, I mean, the Chinese are certainly wanting to learn, wanting to understand, and are interested, whatever they say officially.
I do want to open this up to questions from the audience, but I want to just ask one quick question, Jeff, of you. The U.S. economy is moving ahead dynamically now, but we have not totally put behind some of the things that worried people in Asia about the U.S. ability to follow through on its commitments in the rebalance strategy. One of the most important of those is the sequestration issue, which was sequestration was suspended but hasn't been repudiated. And the issue there is if sequestration comes back, the both caps on the military budget and especially rigidities in how that budget can be spent are very substantial. The Pentagon talks about that in very, very tough terms. Do you see sequestration as being a potentially serious issue for us going forward and affecting some of our how we're seeing in Asia?
I don't think you can completely count out sequestration, because the first time sequestration was introduced, the whole concept was this is such a dramatic, draconian, and bad solution that it will force us to reach a different agreement, because there's no way that we would accept sequestration. And then we did for a period of time. So based on that, I think you don't want to dismiss out of hand that it could happen again. On the other hand, I am fairly confident, based upon conversations with people on the Hill and people within the Pentagon, that they are moving forward with the expectation that it won't happen, that wiser heads will prevail this next time around. And I think our partners around the world are betting on that as well. You know, if you look at our allies and how they're planning for our Navy to shift from a 50-50 split between the Atlantic and the Pacific to a 40-60 split between the Atlantic and Pacific. You know, we're having intense conversations not only with Australia but with other allies such as the Philippines in the region about how we can integrate more fully. And they wouldn't be doing that if they really expected that sequestration was a likely possibility. As I said, I don't fully discount it, but I've got greater confidence in Congress to get it right this next time around than a few years ago when we lost our way for a bit.
So this coming year is going to be extremely important for some major developments between the executive and legislative branches in the U.S., both on the trade side and on the sequestration side.
Yeah, well, I'm waiting for the year that the budget doesn't matter. This is going to be another important year for the budget.
Let's open this to questions from the audience. I'll ask that you briefly identify yourself. Feel free to direct your questions to one or another panelist up here or to ask it of the panel as a whole. And please keep your questions concise. Yes, sir. Back here, if you wait for the microphone coming.
Thank you, Kenneth, and thank you to all the members of the panel for giving up their time today. Aaron Tuckey, the University of Western Australia. My questions to the whole panel, though, Tom might have a special interest in answering this one. The question is, given that the USA and Australia are the two largest per capita emitters of greenhouse gases and have both survived the economic crisis in relatively very good health, what scope is there for the USA and Australia to be leaders in the Asia-Pacific region, and specifically for leading by example in regards to showing China into a clean, green energy future, rather than focusing on their respective environmentally irresponsible economic advantages of exporting shale and LNG when considering energy policy on the whole in the Asia-Pacific region? Thank you.
Wow.
I think that question is for you.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to put up a stout defense of LNG as a cleaner fuel than coal. And one of the most significant steps the world could take to reduce greenhouse emissions is to substitute Chinese coal use with LNG. So I think greater investment by the United States in with Australia in producing more LNG and marketing it to China is probably the single most important step we could take. And the other one would be further supply. This may not be popular with some of your friends, to supply uranium to China for a much larger increase in their nuclear option rather than coal.
Yeah, I'd say the U.S. has had the largest drop in carbon emissions and carbon intensity of any country in the world. In fact, we used to be the largest carbon emitter. Now we're behind China and we're dropping fast for a number of reasons. And one of them is a substitution of natural gas for coal and oil. It burns cleaner. It's lower in carbon. But then we've also expanded our development of renewables. We've recommitted to nuclear and any other solution that will reduce carbon intensity. And I think our development of more natural gas, particularly through shale gas, has actually been a net positive for the world in terms of reducing carbon emissions. So I think we have a very good position from which to be a leader in the world and to stand on a bully pulpit.
Yes, sir. Again, the microphone will come across.
Bernard Gordon, University of New Hampshire. To Mr. Stoller or to Ms. Jacobson as well, with regard to TPP, is there, for example, most of you have said correctly that TPP is much more than a broad FTA. The behind-the-border issues are very, very, very significant. So with regard to China, is there a format in terms of phasing in the China potential accession that would make it more feasible than it is now being talked about as if it were a black and white, in or out? Some of this has been talked about, but I'd like to hear how you see those issues.
Well, you know, that's actually one of the best ways of solving this kind of a problem. And, in fact, in the case of China's accession to the WTO, they didn't accept fully all the obligations overnight. I mean, many of those things were phased in over periods even longer than 10 years in some cases. So I mean, if I were a negotiator dealing with the Chinese and I ran into an obstacle that looked like it would either prevent China's immediate adoption of the rules or allow them to phase in over time, that would be an option I would say would be very attractive. In fact, it's not just a country like China that you use it with. When Australia and New Zealand negotiated a free trade agreement with the ASEAN countries a few years ago, they built in important rules on investment, but then they said, we're not actually going to trigger those rules until we have a subsequent negotiation with the ASEAN. So I think that's a really good suggestion, a really good way to approach it, because if we do have really strong rules in the TPP like we should, then we should facilitate a more gradual Chinese phase-in if we need to.
Okay. Yes.
My name is Li Yang. I just wonder if you can address the issues, the adverse impact of this TPP or whatever multi-corporation in this world trade. For instance, because they are represented by a politician or by ambassador or by some representative, but they don't really speak for general public either from the United States or overseas on the indigenous population. So I just wonder if you can address the issues of general public of either U.S. or other countries in terms of their cultural values or social values, so they will not adverse impact on their elections or their misleading public-private partnership. You know, as long as they have this control power, they will affect the communication of people, including internet communications, social media, everything. So people's voices are not heard. So could you address just about adverse impact on the election or capitalism? It's not really capitalism. It's really use of public, abuse of public or government power to suppress the citizens here and overseas.
Thank you. No, I'm very happy to take that on. I think two things. One is that in terms of what TPP is, you know, intended to accomplish for American citizens, the idea is that it will allow our economy to continue to grow as we become more of a globalized economic world. And so for Americans, you know, we've always gotten wealthy on the fact that our consumers buy a lot of our own stuff. We haven't had to export nearly as much. But as we see the world becoming more global, as we see middle classes rising around the world, we know that they want our stuff and that we're better off selling it outside the United States and to balance out our economy. For China, it's just the opposite. China has been mostly export-driven. They need to build their own consumer base, and we complement that by trading more with China. It advantages both economies for us to expand and increase our trade between the between them as world markets have changed. In terms of impact on the culture of countries through these trade agreements, they don't really affect the culture of a country. What they do is they affect the culture of the business environment. And business people want to be able to trade all around the world with as much efficiency and with as little friction as possible. So they just want a clean set of rules that they can all understand, that reduce conflict, and that allow them to operate. Every country is going to have its own cultural values and norms and ways of structuring their governance, and those won't be materially affected by business arrangements. But business is going to help every country trust each other, work better together, raise their own prosperity, and reduce the risk for conflict. So it's a net win, and that's, I think, how we explain it to the public.
Can I just make an addition to that? That is that in none of these agreements is there going to be 100% compliance by everybody with all the provisions of the agreements. In a modern trade agreement these days, everybody has a list of some exceptions, and these exceptions are often designed to deal with the kind of problems that you're talking about. For example, if the United States is part of a TPP that includes provisions on government procurement, because the United States cares about small business, it will have an exception for small business set-asides that are part of procurement. In the case of Australia, Australia will have to take an exception for the fact that they don't allow majority foreign ownership in Qantas. And the way you get to those exceptions is it's the responsibility of the individual governments to decide where the kind of concerns you're talking about are important enough that they have to be X'd out of the agreement and then negotiate those things. But not the United States, not Australia, not any member of the TPP is going to trample over all the sensitivities.
Yes, back to Stanley.
Stanley Roth, still Boeing. want to ask a question that I was tempted to ask the previous panel but thought they might think it a softball. But given the expertise on security, politics, economics, and trade, I'm asking this quite generally. Do you see a single major problem between the U.S. and Australia at this moment in any of these fields? A year ago, I would have said, sure, Australia concerned about the vigor with which the administration pursuing TPP. That's gone away. This panel and the previous panel has dismissed, and I agree with the U-White thesis, which would be a huge problem if it was there. Barring that, you know, I'm having a hard time coming up thinking major issues in the relationship as opposed to areas of cooperation which we can advance going forward, which I think we've heard a lot.
I'll actually add a footnote to that because there's one issue that I think we has been a source of some concern very recently, and that is the strong U.S. presidential commitment to climate change negotiations this year and to reaching an effective agreement at the end of the year in Paris. And the Abbott government has actually moved in the other direction in terms of dealing with carbon emissions in Australia. So let me just add that to the mix. Feel free to say that's not key. There is some other issue, but Linda.
I wouldn't, Stanley, call it a major issue. And I would certainly say the climate change is the number one real important issue on which the two countries don't agree. But a smaller issue is this question of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. I think this, and we heard yesterday on Capitol Hill the same type of argument, would have been something that the United States shouldn't have had such a strong opinion to try and persuade its allies to wait and see, should have perhaps just let its allies do what the allies wanted to do, whatever that was, go in immediately, take a look at the terms of agreement or whatever. I think there was a lot more disagreement than we have been let on to understand on that issue. And as it isn't a strategic issue, on that I think it would be important for Australia, in this case, to show that it has its own independent foreign policy.
Yeah, I think even on climate change, in a relatively flat landscape of problems, even a small molehill, can seem larger than it is. I don't think there's a dramatic difference. If you look at where the U.S. and Australia are, they both have made commitments to reduce their carbon emissions. I think the ways in which they've been trying to accomplish those have shifted over time. The U.S. was originally going to try and do it through a market solution, and you had, Kerry McCain, Lindsey Graham, Lieberman, you had tripartisan support for it. You had, because Lieberman may be both. So you really had you had support for that. I think Australia saw that, actually got out ahead, created a market. The U.S., for internal domestic political reasons, wasn't able to get that through the House after the midterm elections, started going a different direction. Australia started to think, well, we're a little bit too far out in front, started to pull back a little bit. The U.S., saying we're a little bit behind, had California, the tri-state area, other elements of governance within the United States go into market solutions. We're all sort of fudging around this general sense of how do we, within our political environments, create the most efficient system for reducing carbon emissions. Both countries are struggling with it, but in terms of are our goals different? Are the set of tactics that we're looking at different? Are there different constituencies within the country pushing and tugging for the we're actually in very similar shape. And so the rhetoric tends to magnify what I think are relatively modest differences in how we're trying to approach the same problem.
I'd agree with Jeff. I mean, I think the differences on the climate change issue are largely rhetorical. Yeah. It shouldn't be forgotten that Australia has signed the Kyoto Agreement. The United States hasn't. I think the differences are more likely to be on prioritizing the areas of cooperation and the intensity and different priorities around that.
There certainly aren't even any molehills, really, in the trade and investment relationship.
Yeah. Well, with that flat landscape, I again want to thank the sponsors and organizers of this event, of the whole day, Alliance 21, the U.S. Studies Center at the University of Sydney, and the Brookings Institution. A couple of announcements. We have a buffet lunch for you. You have 25 minutes to eat it and get back in here and seated, because at 12:30, we will have a keynote address by Minister of Foreign Affairs, Julie Bishop. The buffet lunch is in the corridor right out here, but please use the rear exit, the exit behind you there, to get to it, so that we can avoid a traffic jam where people are coming at the lunch tables from two different ends at the same time. This has been a wonderful session. Please join me in thanking our speaker.